Welcome to Rooted. Welcome to my yellow bench for another episode where we'll explore the human side of sustainability leadership. This time I'm speaking with Abby Chicken, who is the head of sustainability at Openreach. And I know you're going to really enjoy this conversation. It's a really wide-ranging and open conversation, and we cover lots of different ground. And yeah, I think you're going to really enjoy it. I wanted to say before we dive into the episode, just a thank you to you for supporting the podcast and for listening and for being part of the Rooted community. It feels like something's really kicking off here in a really good way. We've had getting on for between 500 and 600 listens of the podcast since it started last year. And I'm told that's really quite a lot for a new podcast. And so, yeah, I want to say thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting it. And thank you also for anything you're doing to spread the word through following it and liking it and commenting and sharing it with a friend and all those good things. So, yeah, thank you once again. And let's enjoy the episode. So joining me on my yellow bench today is someone who is currently leading sustainability on one of the biggest infrastructure projects in the UK, I'm told. She's head of sustainability at Openreach, which is the company that runs the UK's digital network, the phone and broadband services that we all use. She's led sustainability for over 10 years, previously working at Selfridges and before that a background in retail. Alongside all of this work, she's involved in all sorts of other things. So she's on the board of Surrey Wildlife Trust, was previously director of volunteer engagement at Pride in London. Her LinkedIn profile shows all sorts of other things that she's involved with. And I actually feel like I have known her for a while because she's very active on LinkedIn. And of course, I live there too. So this is actually the first time we've met, but I can't wait to get stuck in and welcome you, Abby Chicken. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Apologies for ranting on LinkedIn, but I do love it.
No, it's not. It's not ranting. It's lovely. It makes it what it is, doesn't it? That you actually see people with opinions and things to share, and it's lovely. So yes, I do feel like I know you a little bit, but I'm looking forward to getting to know you properly.
We'll compare notes at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And kind of, I guess, delving beneath the surface of what we put out on social media and all the kind of shiny headlines and all that kind of stuff, and really getting into the human side of how it really feels to do this work. So that's what we're all about on Rooted. So going to be trying to dig around a bit, if that's okay with you.
Sounds good.
Lovely. Okay, so I think let's begin at the beginning, as they say. And I'm really interested in understanding, where did your roots in this work begin? Because you didn't always start off in sustainability, right? You came to that partway through your career. So what led you down this path of sustainability to where you are now?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because sustainability as a job, I know it did exist because I've met some of the stalwarts in the kind of environmental movement, but it never occurred to me as a job. And yet it sort of did. So I went to university, I did English and didn't really know what to do. And I went through all of the career stuff and they said, oh, you could go into publishing or advertising. And I thought, yeah, I don't know. My mum was an accountant. She was very keen that I became an accountant, but yeah, I'm not very good at math. So
yeah, best to avoid that particular route.
And that's not even true. I'm not that bad at maths. I just didn't love it. I went to a grad fair and I spoke to the team at Waitrose, and Waitrose at the time had this brilliant story around how they treated their farmers and how they worked with their farmers that I loved. And it was sort of at Waitrose that I started to understand a bit more about what was then corporate sustainability, corporate social responsibility.
Yep.
So they had this foundation with some of the growers in South Africa on kind of avocados and things like that. And I thought, you know, this is brilliant. This is a company that takes pride in treating its suppliers really well and sort of, you know, communicating with the public on this. So It did start kind of right at the start, but I was on a shop floor grad scheme. So I was running the front of house operations, running stores. And then I kept bouncing around within the John Lewis partnership. And I did, there's a guy, Roman Krasnarek, he wrote a book and it's all about taking a radical sabbatical, how to find meaningful work. And I thought, I was in my probably early 30s, late 20s, I think. And I thought, I don't know, I like retail, I like people, but I feel like I kind of want to do something more. I want to contribute more. So I kept getting these shadowing opportunities or little projects in various different teams. And one of the directors, director of public affairs, said, oh, I think CSR is a fit for you. And so she introduced me to the director of CSR and I worked for him for a bit. But then I always ended up getting fired back into shops. And so it was only at Selfridges that I sort of made the leap across from, I was running the Selfridges food hall and then went into Selfridges sustainability. So yeah, it's definitely been a thread for longer than it is on my CV.
It sounds like it's drawn you to organisations, even if it didn't draw you to the actual work itself, that sort of idea of giving back and of being a purposeful organisation.
Yeah, and Selfridges was a game changer because they're a fairly small footprint. You know, they're four shops. They've got a big voice and at the time, huge ambitions. So that was when I landed in Selfridges. They had this enormous campaign on ocean plastics and it was such an eye-opener. And I was like, oh my God, like I hadn't realized about the extent of plastic pollution and it was such an education. So that was a good place to make the leap.
Just going back to that, that grad fair and sort of being exposed, I suppose, to the, how would we put it? Like the purpose or the good that an organization, a big organization can do in the world. What was kind of leading up to that point then? I mean, was that something you were interested in like at school or in your childhood? Was there sort of themes of trying to do the right thing or give back in some way or?
Yes, not in such a noble way. I am a bit of an agitator and okay. I kind of have this sort of endless sense of activism, I think, which to my parents' frustration, you know, there are points when in my garden, I was about 8 years old, we had somebody who came over to cut down some of the trees. And I was a tree sitter. I sat at the top of my favorite apple tree being like, you are not cutting this one down.
Wow.
So my parents bought this kind of tiny cottage with a...
Age 8 years old?
Yeah. But this was my tree. And I was like, nobody is coming for this tree. So I sat there the entire day. And then there were things where, you know, our house sort of abridged onto common land and then there were some farmers' fields. And one day there was a hunt and they were shooting off the common land, which they could, onto towards a fox. And I had this, I think it was my brother's sort of 1980s fluorescent yellow T-shirt. So I put this T-shirt on and ran out in front of these, my mum was losing it, in front of these hunters because I was like, they're not killing these foxes. I'm not, you know, so I had this, I don't even know where this came from, but this real sense of I can do stuff. So there was agency at a really young age.
Yeah.
And I mean, I grew up in kind of the Wye Valley, Forest of Dean area. So very connected with nature. And it sort of felt like all of these threads came together that I did feel like you could go and do stuff and you should if you can.
Yes. So I'm interested in sort of how you ended up in a grad career fair looking at big organisations, because almost with that start, you would think this is a child that's going to be like really an activist, you know, and go down a charities, NGO kind of route, you know, and really push hard through that mechanism.
Sort of, I guess the counterfold to that was my parents' kind of ambitions and what a good job looked like. And I was speaking to somebody recently about this, you know, what feels like achievement and the title, the pay, the things that you're kind of brought up being like, you know, you work hard in school and this is where you'll go. I always come back to, there's this one really profound fork in a road, which was when I just graduated and I was volunteering at a charity called Siren. They were based sort of down in Newbury and they had a role paying almost nothing, but you'd live on site and they're like, you fundraise to go and track wolves in the wild in Spain. And if you fundraise enough, then you get to come. But basically, we can't afford to pay you anything. And I was doing that, and I had the interview on the grad scheme. And I remember kind of going, I could pursue this, and I'm going to have no money, and I might get to do something amazing, but I might not. And it's all a bit weird and unstructured. Or I could go down this really safe next step, which my parents would be very proud of, that I've got on the Waitrose grad scheme. And I sat there and I spoke to the owners of this charity, and they kind of went, look, we know probably what decision you're going to make. We're not going to try and convince you otherwise. And it's like, maybe you could try and convince me a bit.
Please try.
Yeah. And actually, you know, Waitrose was a brilliant education in business and in sort of how you can kind of connect and do things differently. And I've loved it. But yeah, I often come back to actually, what if I had been braver and kind of gone, actually, I'm not going to pursue the thing that my parents want me to do. I'm going to go into this complete wild unknown, and who knows what I'd be doing. But I feel like both paths eventually led me somewhere in sort of the same place.
So. Converged, yeah. And your route to where you are, you know, what you're doing today, and that activism being expressed and that agency being expressed via a big organisation with massive impact, but you kind of had to go through, yeah, a different route to get there. That's so interesting. And yeah, we often have these little fork in the road moments, don't we? But I do, yeah, you're right. I do think we sometimes we'd always converge back on a similar type of outcome in some ways. Yeah, really interesting. I guess looking on your career then, I'm interested then in what part of your career, or what, whether it's a specific project or a specific role or a time in a role, but what you look back on with pride on the work you've done so far.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I mean, I touched on this with Selfridges and the activism thread. The owner of Selfridges at the time believed in what we called retail activism, that you could be a brand that stands up and sort of advocates for the right thing. And so we did some fun, brilliant things at Selfridges. Probably the best and maybe hardest one was convincing the beauty industry to ditch plastic glitter. So so they'd long been working in plastics, and it was all about packaging. And then we got rid of straws and microbeads and all of this stuff kind of ahead of national bans. So we had a big fashion show with the last plastic bags in about 2015. And then we said, well, actually, you know, we've stopped selling anything that's got microbeads, but there are so many brands selling glitter and it's just plastic. And you, at the time, the crossover with Pride was definitely a kind of convening point, because I was like, there's loads of people who are covering
yes.
themselves in glitter.
My goodness.
And then you
yeah.
go home and you have a shower and you're just washing the stuff down the sink. So we started to work with various of the beauty brands, and a lot of them are much, much bigger than Selfridges. So you're talking kind of the L'Oreal's, the Estee Lauder's. And it was just not very easy. But then we convinced a few big beauty advocates, Pat McGrath being the kind of game changer. So Pat McGrath was famous for the glitter lip. And once we spoke to their team and explained what we were trying to do, and they said, yeah, we can get behind this, we're going to do this, it became a much easier conversation to have with other massive beauty brands. So that was cool.
That is cool. Was that sort of part of a strategy, like we're going to go for Pat McGrath, like because of, or was it more of a, we're going to speak to loads of people, and yeah, when this person is convinced, then it kind of created a snowball effect? Was it strategic and intentional, or was it a feeling it or your way through it?
It was sort of strategic in a fairly reactive way. So I'd been doing a load of work on how much plastic is in these products specifically, and there's plastic in everything. I learned so much, like mascara, you know, yeah. lengthening mascara has plastic fibers that lengthen your eyelashes. So it's in so much of beauty. So this was totemic rather than kind of sort of a seismic shift. There is still tons yes. of plastic in beauty, which is so weird. But we launched Pat McGrath into the UK, and it was a big takeover, and they had these, you know, these kind of huge, and you could go and get your glitter lip done, and it was like 40 quid to have this amazing experience. And I thought, I'm having this conversation upstairs, trying to convince people to get rid of glitter, while downstairs they are selling as hard as they can. And we thought, we've got to start with Not the Chanel were brilliant and all over it, but Chanel is not exactly a big glittery brand. They're not a brand that is selling to teenagers who are going clubbing.
Yeah.
So they weren't where the problem was. So we thought we've got to take it to these kind of brash and bold brands who are having this impact and who can make the change. So it felt like that was a good place to start because they were just in the shop everywhere at the time.
That's fascinating. And yeah, that bit about you were working on, that was at the same time as you were involved heavily with Pride.
And yes.
How did you then take that conversation into Pride and try?
Yeah, so I wrote a whole sustainability strategy for Pride, which was outside my actual role, which was about volunteers. But we said, how can we do a green Pride? And this was just channeling all of the day job stuff, actually. Can we look at the footprint and the amount of diesel vehicles on the footprint, and can we try and advocate for, and bearing in mind this was well before most of the EV transition, but can we change that? Can we look at disposables? Because people used to have balloon clouds and they've let them all go. And, this is A, helium, B, plastic.
And lots of, I don't know how best to describe it other than tat being given away all the way along the route.
Sunglasses, cheap electronics, cans, everything.
Yeah.
So we started, because actually the footprint of Pride in terms of its own control is relatively small. And we looked at, you've got volunteer t-shirts. So we spoke to T-Mill and they could re-mill your t-shirts. So we had, all of these kind of interventions, but actually the biggest problem was not us. It was all of the brands who were marching, who were giving away all kinds of stuff that nobody needs. So, so we then said, okay, can we, for everyone who's attending, we'll have glitter stations and makeup artists who are using eco glitter. And we will say, we're just trying to educate people. So when you sign up a group, can you try not to use a single use t-shirt? Try not to give away stuff that nobody needs. Please don't let balloons, we banned balloons outright. Because there are more creative ways to do this. And we were looking at, things like the Dia de los Muertos parades in Mexico, where they have these huge puppets all made of papier-mâché, and you can have an amazing impact without having a load of single-use, unsustainable stuff. Like you can do it in a really cool way. So,
When you're talking about these two things that were kind of happening at the same time, like the sort of theme I'm getting from you is that it's an impact because it's an impact you're proud of, perhaps because it was very visible and it was bold and it was creative. And like, are those sort of things that speak to you more generally in your work? Is that kind of how you do your best work, kind of by doing big, bold, visible, creative things?
It's where I get the most energy, probably.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with one of our MDs the other day, and he said, sustainability is a small number of big things and a big number of small things, and that's the strategy.
Oh, hold on a minute.
So
say
exactly,
that again.
I did this. A small number of big things and a big number of small things. So he's like, if you've got a few iconic, bold, centrally led, groundbreaking things, that's brilliant. But actually, the big number of small things is all of the behavioral stuff that also adds up. So it is the put stuff in the right bin, don't use a disposable coffee cup. It's all of that that creates this groundswell. And actually, both of those matter, because it's easy to go, oh, we're the sustainability team, we're just going to focus on one or the other. So I quite liked that.
Yeah.
But I have had to say that to everybody over and over again in my head.
More than once.
Right.
Yeah.
Small number of big things, big number
Maybe
of small things.
Maybe get a banner or a big poster. Or a t-shirt. We can have it on a t-shirt.
Not single use t-shirts. Sorry. No.
Sorry. I'll wear it every day, I promise.
Wear it 30 times.
I feel like what's quite interesting is, I think some of us are naturally more drawn, aren't we, to the small number of big things, and others are naturally more drawn to a big number of small things. Like, let's just get, let's just kind of like work through in a very systematic way, like lots of small actions, let's see them add up. And sometimes you can, if you're lucky enough to have a big enough team, you can, some of those talents or inclinations can kind of naturally settle. Do you see that a bit? Do you see that kind of?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm a big believer in building a team who have kind of cognitive dissonance in a way, the diversity of thought, I think, is really important, because then my team will tell anyone, but I get very excited about a lot of ideas, and I'll be like, we should do this, we should do this, we should do this. And they're like, yeah, but what are we actually going to do?
Yes.
Because I can get very enthusiastic about 17 different initiatives a day. So actually, let's kind of structure it and pin it down, and we're going to actually go and do these two big things, and we're going to do them really well. And then we're also going to have an engagement section that is really kind of gearing through our internal comms of what are the drumbeat behaviors. But even that, it might be a quite a small number of small things. If we're just saying our sort of overriding philosophy has been use less stuff, because that is one thing that everyone can remember and everyone can really go and do in whatever role they work in. So because we are perennially short on attention span, everyone's kind of like, what's the one thing? What's the smallest thing I've got to remember? So use less stuff.
Yeah. And that resonates with people for whom sustainability might not be a kind of top priority for them, but they know they're working for a company that's trying to make some money, or, you know, trying to work within a budget. Like that speaks to people for whom, yeah, you're just trying to be not wasteful, you're trying to be cost efficient, all those other things it talks to. So yeah,
I think that's really important to, you know, not just dilute your sustainability ambitions, but to make sure that you are speaking the language of the business or going where the energy in the business is, while trying to tug it into maybe some different level of ambition. And for us, cost control is massive. So that's an easy one to get through in our boardroom conversations. So yeah, it definitely helps.
Thinking about the example you gave me about the glitter, it strikes me that that is a very creative and visible thing. I mentioned that already. Do you get the opportunity to do that type of exciting creative thing in your work now? Because on the face of it, I'm sitting here thinking, oh, she's kind of gone from glamorous Selfridges with glitter lips and mascara and all this, and now she's in, you know, cables and cabinets in the street. And do you still get to do exciting big things even though it's in a much different environment?
Yeah, I really do. And it brings out my deep inner nerd. And I love it.
Okay.
I was in a meeting the other day where somebody said, this solution we've just released this week is physics in action in its most elegant form. And I thought, God, I'm going to go and have that on a t-shirt as well.
Right.
So we have, you know, I had some fun at Selfridges, but Selfridges does sell a lot of things that you don't need. And it's very, you said it's very glamorous. It's very kind of visual. So there's some great ways of intervening with that. But actually, the philosophies are the same. But at Openreach, what we do really genuinely helps, not just, you know, sustainability is not just kind of us doing this hygiene factor of kind of doing the right thing. There is something that helps the whole of the UK become more sustainable in lots of different ways, whether that's because of telecommuting and sort of reducing carbon, or underpinning smart technologies, or just not having physical materials. This is the thing that's been exciting us all year, actually. We've got a new, it's not new technology, but we've just launched, you can put an acoustic signal through one of our fiber cables and it can listen to stuff. So basically, if you put this acoustic pulse, if there's an interruption to that, you can map it to what they call a sonic library, and AI can kind of go, okay, that sounds like the same thing that we're hearing all across the network. In this instance, water leaks. So
right.
It can listen for water leaks. So we've been working with Affinity Water, and this has just been a trial. It was like 650 kilometers of their network, and we were saving them 2 million litres of water a day.
So wait a minute. Your broadband cables can listen for water leaks.
Yeah, that sounds sort of nefarious when you put it that way. No, so a fiber optic cable has light traveling through it.
Yeah.
So if the light has, it's kind of called a backscatter, if there's a blockage or something, it creates this profile, which then if you record that, then yeah, you can kind of go, okay, that's, and it can take out sort of background noise. So we've said, right, listen for water leaks. It can listen for all kinds of things. So there's a program at the University of Southampton where they are mapping whales and sharks around offshore wind, because subsea cables can kind of do that as well. So the trial we've just published was with Affinity, and we will go big on water, but we can do gas leaks. There's a lot of headroom for this.
That's so exciting. And it just, so I've been having a bit of a moan and a bit of a whinge about AI recently. It's kind of more about like AI content and just crap that you see on online. And I love hearing about a story like this where it's like, yeah, because we have AI, we can take this technology and we can really turn it into something that's actually useful in the real world to actually be more sustainable. Like that's the kind of AI that we should be hearing more about, right?
Yes. I mean, machine learning solutions have, again, been around for a really long time. And I think it does get blended with this sort of nano banana. I'm going to have a picture of Trump doing a little dance. Yeah, that's not good use of anything, my attention span, any of it. But yeah, there are some cool solutions as well. And I think on balance, AI can be harnessed for good.
Sure.
So that's an exciting space as well.
Yeah, really, really interesting. I'm going to remember that one because, yeah, like I say, I've been on this real downer about AI. And I'm like, I just want all the robots to go away and leave us alone and let us get back to being humans. But then you hear a story where you're like, yes, we'll have them on this. What I'm interested to turn to, if you're okay with it, is I guess where the tougher times might have been, what's felt hard, where the challenging times have been. Can you?
Yeah, I can. And I think, again, that's a great segue because it is really easy to get so overwhelmed and down about stuff and stuff we have no control over. Like the AI genie is out of the bottle. So then, and it really depends on the day of the week and what mood you're in and time of the month and everything else as to whether you kind of go, oh God, this is just a lot and it's grim, or my preferred stance, all change is opportunity. And if things are changing really fast, then we've got an opportunity to accelerate. I can't always manifest that headspace, but it is my favorite way to look at things that, you know, this change feels like it's coming at us in all directions. So what can we do? What can we use? And how can we do better out of this? But I guess for me, when things get really tough, probably three things help the most. One is community, talking to other sustainability leaders. And this is why I do really love LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Because there are some brilliant people and I'm connected to loads of sustainability people. And I kind of go, oh, okay, they are facing this same challenge or they've found this brilliant solution. Or, do you know what? That's just something I hadn't heard about. Which leads me into positive news, which I actively try to tune into because there's a lot of bloody negative news everywhere. So can we go and find some stuff that, yeah, actually we have got the technology and we are seeing more and more people who want more nature, who want a cleaner, fairer world. You know, there's, if you just tune out the big establishment media for a second, there's a load of us who are making really positive difference every day. And then the other one is, and this is when it gets really bad, just getting out and getting your hands dirty. But I feel like I'm just sort of doing reporting and I'm not really making real change. I can just go and do a litter pick and kind of go, well, I've changed that tiny bit of ground, or I've just gone and planted. I was out with some other sustainability people on Friday planting trees. We only planted 9 trees between a group of us. It was really hard going, loads of rocks. But actually, in 30 years' time, there's going to be 9 sugar maples somewhere in Wiltshire. And yeah, that feels very good.
So just on the community and on the positive news, you mentioned LinkedIn. Do you still find that you can use and get what you need out of LinkedIn? Because it's, I mean, it changes. It seems to change all the time in terms of like what comes up on your feed and like how much of other people that you're really interested in, how much content of theirs you're seeing versus other random stuff. Do you still find that you get that sense of community, you get that positive news through that channel, or do you have to kind of go elsewhere as well?
I do. And I don't know if it's because my algorithm is so very well trained Because I hear people who say, oh God, I hate LinkedIn. It's such a negative or such a self-promoting place. And there's this comedian, Farrell Hegarty, who does these brilliant clips on LinkedIn where everything is, oh, I'm delighted. I'm thrilled.
Oh, yes.
And it just really makes me laugh because that is also true. But yeah, I think my feed does tend to be a combination of just genuine updates where somebody's got, oh, you know, I'm celebrating because I've done this thing, won an award, got this new job. And if you take it on trust that's genuine, then that's a great thing. You know, someone celebrating, haven't got a promotion, let's all go and give
them
a big high five.
Let's be delighted.
Let's be thrilled. Thrilled for you. But yeah, I do also have just a great cohort of people I'm connected with. And increasingly so. I went to a college reunion last week, and the number of us who are working sort of in and around sustainability is growing year on year because people's jobs are starting to get more of a remit on this. So people who didn't start their careers looking to be in sustainability just are now. So that's been quite good. And then I'm on this huge sustainability WhatsApp group, which I often find quite overwhelming, and I will meet it. But then every so often, if you've got a question, and it can be anything like, you know, where would you host a great sustainability event that's in Kent? And you'll get, you know, you can get some great solutions from that.
How's this group? Are you allowed to share the secrets of it in such a public forum as a podcast?
Oh, that's a good question.
Is it invite only?
No, I don't think it is, but I don't own it. I got invited.
The first rule of the WhatsApp group is don't talk about it.
I got invited onto this WhatsApp group because there was a whole, I think it was a bitching session about something we launched at Selfridges that I'd put on LinkedIn. God, this is a theme. So Selfridges did a garden centre, and I posted a picture of the Selfridges compost, and it was peat-free compost in a Hessian sack. I was like, how unexpected. You know, you've got luxury department store selling peat-free compost in a Hessian sack. And majority of people were like, this is cool, this is different, this is interesting. And then I had a few deep green sustainability people going, oh, it's not Koya. And actually, where did you get that? And I thought, you know, the customers don't make the leap. My customers are not going to go from I'm buying plastic wrapped peat compost into Koya because they've never even bloody heard of Koya. Like, there is a stepping stone thing. So actually, if we can get them from that onto this, and explain why that's good, then maybe you get them from this heat-free compost into being like wild women of the woods.
You might need to go through the sort of the artisan compost, you know, woven compost.
Yeah. There we go.
Yeah.
But so I think somebody said, well, should we invite this woman who's put this LinkedIn post up to come and speak for herself? And so I got invited in and never looked back.
Yeah. And I think that just having these like informal groups or smaller groups, it can be good. Like the People Planet Pint, that's quite a nice.
I was just going to say that.
Oh, were you? Yeah. They're quite a nice set of groups because they're small and they're local as well.
Yeah. The regionality of it, I think, is brilliant because, I mean, I work in London, but sort of speaking to people where I live is just lovely. And you kind of find people involved in all kinds of things. Yeah. It's great. So yeah, community, I think, is huge.
And I think, so personally, I'm not a massive fan of the really big events. I find them, they can be a bit, I mean, I go to them, but they can be quite corporate sort of spin. And having been somebody who went to those events as a corporate leader and had my set of speaking points to, you know, they can feel a bit constrained in that way. So I really like sort of when I find one of these events that's a little bit smaller, a little bit more informal, a little bit less corporate spin. I'm kind of drawn to those ones. And yeah, if you've got a WhatsApp group or something in the pub or just something that's a bit more informal, that seems to be the way.
Yeah,
to go.
And I do love. I mean, I am probably I'm an oversharer in many ways, and I don't always toe the corporate line. So the last panel thing I did was at Sustainability Live, and it was on It was around International Women's Day and it was on women in sustainability.
I was going to ask you about this.
I just got so pissed off about the whole concept. And I didn't mean it as an aggression to Sustainability Life because they are doing absolutely a great thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think they took it that way. But I did have this kind of like, oh God, how annoying is it that we're still having this conversation? And I think it's, you've got to be able to have conversations like that. But International Women's Day is just so like fucking reductive.
Yeah.
And it wasn't designed to be that way.
How did it go, your panel? I think you put something in advance to say, I'm pissed off, I'm doing this, but I'm going to do it and come and see me. How was the actual conversation? Did it challenge some of that thinking? Did it go
it was
there?
Great. It was a great group of women who, I tried to offer my place to somebody because there's a guy who I work sort of on a different thing with, who advised the King of Saudi Arabia on women's inclusion. And I thought, you're far more qualified to talk on sort of D&I stuff than I am, because I think the thing that qualifies me is that I am a woman. And I'm just like, you know, in that spirit of actually, we don't want all single gender panels, let's mix it up. I'll offer my place. He couldn't make it. But no, it was a great discussion. It was quite a feisty discussion. We got a standing ovation. So clearly it resonated. It was fun. But I think because everyone has got to that point of, oh God, I don't want to lean in. I want to lean out. I do not want to go and, you know, I read this thing. The average woman's voice has dropped an octave over the last 50 years because we're all busy trying to lean in so we can sound all manly in the office. And I thought, yeah, we've all been just trying to fit this mold that was never meant for us. And actually, I want to tear it up. I want to break the mold. I want to do things differently. And we are on the cusp of having a female CEO at Openreach who starts at the start of April. And I'm really excited about how that changes the culture because one of the MDs said, I've never had a female boss. And I thought, yeah, this is going to be different.
Yeah, it's really important. And I guess what I sometimes see is, and this perhaps isn't more now, it's perhaps a while back, where you'd get senior female leaders and they'd be in important positions and senior positions and then you'd sort of find out that they kind of just sort of adopted male traits and sometimes even more so than many of the men that I was working with. So I remember when I had my kids and they were little, I'd actually had some really flexible and supportive male bosses. And then I happened to have a few female bosses who were actually really quite tricky and, you know, they just didn't get it. And they were like, well, you know, I managed to do it, so you can too. And it's that kind of attitude, really. So I think things are changing, but I love that. Yeah, I don't want to lean in. I want to lean out. I think I may have said that myself a few times as well.
Yeah, it's that kind of, you know, we spent, and this was the theme of the panel, we've spent millennia trying to break glass windows, glass ceilings, glass doors, break everything because we weren't invited, you know, whether it's politics or religion or work. And then, I mean, for those women, that was how they had to get through. You could only succeed at a certain point by outmanning the men. I don't think we're there anymore.
Yeah, I've had another conversation for this podcast. I'm not sure if it'll come out before or after this one. So I don't know. I don't know. But we're talking, it's with someone who's a board chair and a member of, she has a portfolio career working on lots of boards, Lisa Tennant. And she was telling me on the podcast about her experiences breastfeeding in the boardroom and pumping, you know, leaving to pump milk and then coming back in and saying, well, I had to do that, you know, and I feel proud of showing them that this is what it takes. If you want more women on boards, you kind of have to be okay with this kind of stuff. But yeah, it strikes me that she very much was leaning in. She's like, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep pushing. And if that means I have to bring my baby to a board meeting, then that's what it means.
It's both, isn't it? I've got a friend, Sarah Marshall, who did exactly this, and she would pump in meetings and she'd be like, do you know what? I'm still here and I'm still very capable of doing this. But this is what it takes to bring everything. And as you start to see examples of people doing that, it emboldens everybody because, you know, the conversations that we have about menopause or about reproductive rights or about breastfeeding and what it takes to do that. I just think, gosh, we're talking a lot about inclusion. It's not a zero-sum game. You know, inclusion is good for everybody. And actually, the more we can just lose that attitude of, oh, leave all of your personal life at the door. We don't want to know anything about who you are. It doesn't work. So let's let people be people.
Yeah, just bring. I mean, it's a cliche now, isn't it? Bring your whole self to work. But actually, it is what actually helps. It helps us.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. When I started my career, I was advised by somebody very early who was entirely well-meaning, but she said, oh, I don't think you should come out in your next store. This is on the Waitrose grad scheme. I don't think you should come out. I think it will hold you back.
Oh.
And I had this like months of, oh God, what have I done? Do I have to try and sort of hide a part of myself? And I'm not, like I said, I'm not very good at, if somebody says, oh, well, what did you do on the weekend? I'd be like, oh, I spent the weekend with my friend. I can't do it. Yeah. I've got no poker face. So I thought I can't.
How long did that last? Did you manage to?
I don't think I even tried. No. I had a little crisis, but was in that store with her for a few more weeks. And then I went to my next one and I spoke to a male store manager who was like, oh, don't worry about that. I thought, thank God. And never did. And then that thread followed. It eventually led me into setting up the John Lewis LGBT Network and going to join Pride in London. So,
these little moments, they spur you on. They spur you on, don't they? I wonder, we've covered so much, haven't we? And there's lots of different elements of your career and your life that we've talked about. But I wonder if you might sort of think about our listeners and what I'm trying to build with Rooted is a sort of community of sustainability leaders who listen to this podcast just for that kind of sense of, it's not me. It's not, I'm not the only one who has these issues, or I'm not the only one who finds it tough from time to time, or you know, just having a bit of support from others. What piece of wisdom would you give to others in the same kind of role as you, who might just be having a bit of a tough time or thinking about how they find that kind of purpose in their work? What wisdom would you give?
Well, a very wise newsletter writer released something this week, I think, on Ikigai.
Oh, me?
Yes, you. Was you. And I have, for a long time, kind of been a bit obsessed with Ikigai as well. I think it's such a great concept.
Yes.
Because my job didn't exist, I don't think, when I started in my career. And you know, when you're in school and they're kind of like, oh, this is the kind of jobs that are available to you. And that's ever more so true now. I've got a six-year-old and I think, you know, the job that he's likely to do, I won't even be able to conceive. So actually thinking about your skills, your joys, sort of what the world does need is so much better as a way of kind of thinking about it. So, you know, not every sustainability job has sustainability in the title. And you can use pretty much any job and any skill set to contribute to a movement, whatever that causes.
But so, equally, sorry to interrupt you, but equally, not every job with sustainability in the title is actually necessarily creating a more sustainable world. You know, there's that as well.
True.
Sometimes people can end up in jobs that sound on paper to be very purposeful and aligned with their values. And actually sometimes they aren't.
And they're just reporting. Yeah. And so
both ways.
I think thinking about skills and people and sort of the transferable skills, you know, commercial leadership works in almost any organization, be it sort of volunteering, charity, NGO, like any of those things need that. So, and I've said this a number of times that I think, you know, the best skill set is probably a psychology degree and an MBA, because how people think and how you influence people and then how you influence business are just great in almost any kind of any function that you could possibly choose to go into. So I'd say don't get hung up on the title.
Yeah.
And just try and figure out what gives you energy, what money you need. And So that, I think.
Yeah. And I think, it's been so much on my mind. I've been working, I've had a few clients where I've been like, this is a great thing to kind of, we're going to get this out of the tool bag this week. And it just doing that exercise of kind of going around and thinking, what are those things that I really love doing? What are the things that I'm really good at doing? It's not always a crossover. You'd like to think there'd be some, but it's not always a crossover. What can I be paid for, as you say, and what does the world need? And kind of going around those four areas and really examining those and trying, you know, and it might take some time. It's not just something you can necessarily do in one conversation, but just to kind of think, where's that crossover for me? And to dig down the next level beneath the, oh, I want a job title with sustainability in. No, it's going to be, there's more to it than that. I think that's the thing that I've been definitely exploring with a few people recently.
And just being bold enough to ask as well, because, you know, we work with, in a pretty matrix way. There's loads of people who aren't in the sustainability team, but who are delivering because they've come and said, I work in internal comms and I'm really passionate about this. This is what I do. And so we help them kind of sculpt out goals and stuff that they can deliver from there. So I think just saying, this is how I got into it. I asked the sustainability director and I said, look, this is what I want to do. And some months later, job came up. But yeah, you've kind of got to put yourself out there.
You do have to put yourself out there. I think that is actually a really important piece of advice as well. Just if you don't ask, you won't get, you know, people, things do not fall in your lap, or rarely. You have to be very, very privileged, lucky, things going in the right way for you, all those things, you know, the stars have to be aligned for things to just fall in your lap. You do need to ask and put it out there that that's what you want. It's the, this week I got an email about the Women in Green Business Awards and why we have to have our own awards. I don't know, just on that same point. But anyway, Women in Green Business Awards, nominations are open. And I used to think when I looked at those things, like, oh, it's so lucky that people get nominated and it's so lucky that people end up on the stage. And then, oh, actually, it's not luck. They've nominated themselves and they've written a self-nomination at least half of the time, if not more. You don't get on a stage like that unless you say, I'd like to be on that stage and do your submission. So it's these little moments, isn't it, where you kind of have to just say, yeah, ask.
But it's a bit of self-promotion and it's a bit of, people can say no.
Yeah.
If you say, this was a tip from our new CEO, who said, you know, if you want to be in the meeting, ask.
Yeah.
Like, we can tell you it's not appropriate, but at least you've put your hand up. I did, this was really fun and it's nothing to do with sustainability, but I got in touch with a former colleague who I haven't worked with for more than 10 years and said, I'm just going to embrace the spirit of the juvenile, but my mate fancies your mate. Could we hook them up for a date? And so we did. And because he was just like, yeah, this sounds fun. And so we arranged this very sort of 1980s style. They just met in a bar. They
didn't
have each other's numbers.
That's amazing. I didn't know that ever happened anymore.
I know. And
incredible.
It's been so much fun. And who knows where it goes. But
yeah,
it was only because I just messaged him and he was up for it too. And we kind of went, let's make this happen. This is great.
Yeah, lovely. Oh, what a lovely, heartwarming story to end on. that's great. I think let's call it a day there. That's been just so wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much. Abby, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been really good.
So that was a fab conversation, I think, wasn't it, with Abby there? I've got visions of her as an 8-year-old sitting in the top of that tree, refusing to let it be cut down, and how that agitator, activist tendency and mindset has obviously followed her all the way through her career, her time at Selfridges, her time at Openreach now, to make a big impact in the work that she does. We talked quite a bit about community, and whether that's SAP group or whether it's small or big conferences, any of those ways really is trying to make sure we connect and we share with other sustainability leaders. We talked about those big events too, Anthropy and ED, and my FOMO, missing out on those. But hopefully they will provide lots of support for those who attend as well. So anyway, I'm again grateful for your support, grateful for you listening to podcast, and please do like, subscribe, follow, comment, review, What else? Share any of those things that you feel able to do. As always, I'm very grateful and look forward to speaking to you next time. Bye bye.